A deep dive into the East End of Long Island, New York, with people who are committed to making our beautiful community and the world a more enlightened place. We prize good vibes and offer hope for a brighter, more sustainable future. Join us as we explore at Hamptons Consciousness, the real Hamptons.
Hi guys, we're with Cynthia Daniels, and this is Hamptons Consciousness. I don't know if you guys know who Cynthia is offhand, but she's a very accomplished producer, composer. She's won Emmys, Grammys. She's worked with everyone under the sun, from Chaka Khan to Beyonce, Paul McCartney, Alec Baldwin, Sarah Jessica Parker, you name it.
Thank you for all those accolades, but I mean primarily a recording engineer. So beyond producer and composer, I neither produce nor compose some of those people. I am the engineer for some of their projects.
Tell us more about that. What does that really mean?
Well, back in when I started, when the dinosaurs walked the earth and recording studios were run by cave mice spinning on wheels, a record, for instance, was produced by one person. Then the recording engineer was the technical person who was responsible for setting the mics and getting levels and making sure everything got to tape in a good sounding way with their expertise. And, you know, the composer was a completely different person. These days, often the composer is still a different person or the songwriter. So although, of course, composers are still not always the same person as the producer or engineer, although times have changed that way too, in that, you know, people, composers learn how to use their studios and produce their own things, and I'm sure we all know that. And that's not always a bad thing. It's not a good thing for a commercial recording studio who relies on people to hire the experts, but it's a really good thing for creativity. So those were three different roles. And the studio was a separate thing. So we had different costs, you know, I mean, really we're separating those things, not just by expertise, but all the ways you had to figure a budget for a project. You had to think about the studio, you had to think about the engineer, the producer, and maybe you were the composer. Most people are the composer, or if it's an ad or a film producer, that agency, you know, or that company. So now you call up a studio and ask if the engineer's included, and it is here and everywhere, really, you know, and you get one price. You get the recording studio, the producer, if it's me, and the engineer. Now, often I will get points or something on an album. You know, production deals are different. I'm hired by a lot of people, particularly all the people out here, many of whom, local musicians, most of whom, you know, are incredibly talented. I think that word local sometimes smacks of like yokel, you know, like maybe they're not international. Well, not only are people local and international in the Hamptons, but you don't have to be internationally famous to have the talent of an internationally famous person. Maybe that's something we could talk about or touch on later.
Definitely.
So that's a little something about the different roles and why I say they used to be separate. Now I'm doing a project. I'm often asked to produce and engineer and mix, and then perhaps the last stage, master my own projects.
That's awesome. You wear a lot of hats, which I guess leads us to our next topic. How did you even know that that was a job? How did you know that that was going to be your future job? When did your passion for it first come about?
Well, that's a good question, leading right out of what we just talked about. So the passion began with music, and it really was a very clear event and time of my life when I chose this path. And the path is recording engineer. So the job isn't a music engineer, really. It's a recording engineer. So, you know, there was a pretty clear-cut time and path, and it did come out of my passion for music. I always loved music. You know, it's a classic story of the older sister who listened to music. The Beatles came in, and, you know, all the teen idols from the 60s and the Stones, and she turned me on to, like, popular music. And my parents always had Broadway shows playing. That was their kind of thing.
So you kind of got a full scope.
Well, I got a lot of music in my life. And then there was something called AM radio. And when people my age, you know, we grew up with clock radios waking us up rather than alarm clocks. And we had a radio station. And that magic hasn't changed. You know, and there was always something really magical to me about music. I mean, it not only transported me, it turned me on, kind of probably the way you get turned on when you first realize that you're an athlete, you know, when you start to run or something.
Yeah,
and you're like,
definitely.
Wow, you know, this is great. And that's really how I felt about music. And so, of course, I wanted to, like a lot of people, wanted to learn an instrument. And I had the perfunctory piano lessons when I was really young and couldn't sit and practice at 6 years old. So when I was a teenager, I picked up the guitar. And, you know, by this time, I'd like gone to my first concerts. And there was something so incredible about watching those cute boys, you know, and like their guitars and everyone's long hair and your first experience with pot, maybe. Just like there was this whole magic to the early 70s where I really, you know, was a teenager. And music was just
transformative, shaped that time for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say music shaped that time for a lot of people. Yeah. So that's where the passion is. And then I pick up the guitar. So, of course,
how old are you around by this
point?
Well,
now I'm 14.
Okay.
Right? And I've discovered, of course, the first boyfriend was a guitar player. You know, he would be a series of partners who were musicians.
Okay.
Because that's...
Musicians were your thing.
Well, musicians were my thing because music was my thing.
Right.
And I quickly realized, as I went from one guitar guy after another, that I didn't really want to be the chick on the couch. I wanted to learn the instrument, and I wanted to know what that little machine was where they kept going over and adjusting things. That was the PA system, little tiny ones. You know, I wanted to be involved. I really didn't want to stare at them any longer.
You didn't want to be the groupie?
Didn't want to be the groupie. Never had any desire to be a groupie. I had a desire to be in it.
Which one?
It was a band called Yes. They were prog rock or progressive rock, the kind of like classical and the song Roundabout with the guy with the high voice, John Anderson, and, you know, really trippy stuff. And on the back of Close to the Edge, there was a job, recording engineer, and his name was Eddie Offord. And I said, that's it. That's what I'll do. And I told my parents that. And now my father was an electrical engineer who actually knew how to make hi-fi equipment, which was stereo equipment, and I always had the best stereos of all my friends.
It's kind of in the family.
But I didn't really, you know, kind of take that into account. I really felt like I came up with it on my own. And now I look back, I was probably influenced by all the equipment around and everything, but I dug it. You know, I liked it. I always liked guy things like microscopes and pulling insects apart, not to be cruel to them,
right,
but to look at them under my microscope. So my friendship in the company of males was really solidified, and I mentioned that because this was always a male-dominated business, and certainly at my age back then, not too many girls in engineering. But I never really thought of it, just something for the future to consider, remembering that. So I told my parents I wanted to be an engineer, and my father said, do you want to be an engineer? Like he was, triple E, you know. Electrical engineer, electronics engineer, or a button pusher. That sounded very insulting to me.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, I want to be an engineer. I went to college. They didn't have engineering schools. Now they have production and recording engineering schools for fully matriculated four-year programs. And, you know, they got some amazing equipment, and things were very different. So I went to college, and I basically majored in radio and film broadcasting, which wasn't a bad education. As soon as I could, I got into doing live sound for punk bands at punk clubs and other clubs. And I went to recording engineering school. It was like a trade school in Manhattan. So I took the train in during the summer of my sophomore year. And when I came out, I thought I knew everything. And, you know, there's another story. Guess what? I didn't. By happenstance, I was doing live sound for an all-day concert, and there was a recording truck that was recording it. And my job was not only to plug things in, but to run. The truck asked me to run out and tell me whenever bands changed, and then you change the mic inputs. You know, like, okay, there were two guitars in that band. Now there's four guitars and two singers. You know, you have to plug stuff in like really fast,
right,
and keep track of it. And then, right, they don't know what's going on in the recording truck. So I kept track. They said, hey, would you keep track of this stuff for us and just tell us how the inputs are changing? Then I hooked up with that company. And somehow we got a job at age 22. We got a a contract with ABC Radio to fly around or drive around the country, depending on where it was, and record six of the top country, Western, and country artists. And it was called ABC Country Western Country, sorry, ABC Country Greats Hour. And we conducted the interviews and we recorded everything and we arranged for all the equipment. So sometimes, like I said, we would drive if it was close enough. So the first concert was with someone named Ronnie Millsap, and that was a big truck we rented. And these are people who have won the CMA Awards like 20 times
right.
for songwriting and performance. There are people any country person would know, but maybe not people.
Right, like mainstream wouldn't necessarily know them.
Yeah. So then there's another concert, and it's a little closer. It's at this amazing theater in Virginia called Wolf Trap. And this guy named Johnny Paycheck, who had a song, a hit song, crossover to pop radio called Take This Job and Shove It.
And I actually know that song.
Right, there you go. And so we're outfitting the truck. We pull up, and my partner, Bruce, starts loading the truck with tape machines and a little console and some speakers, and we're building a little recording studio inside. And it was at that moment, the song by Pink Floyd, Welcome to the Machine, came on. And I knew we had worked so many hours already. And there I was about to, you know, spend another 18-hour day doing this. And that was the moment I knew that I was dedicating my life to music business and that my life no longer belonged to me. So there was kind of a bittersweet moment, just like the song Welcome to the Machine is. So they're sitting in a meeting at a record company. Basically, the guy's like, have a cigar. You're going to go far. We're going to make you a star. So Welcome to the Machine. And there was kind of an aspect of, it's going to take every ounce of my life, so I better really want to do it. And I really did. One of my big arrival moments was when I worked with Flora Purim and Ayerto Moreira, which only jazz musicians like really know the power of the musicians who played with them and what their music was. So I'm going to say that. That was in the middle of my jazz career, and I was in my 20s, and I was recording film scores, and I hit it big, young, and then nothing in life goes straight up. So, you know, there was a lot of spiraling. to come.
Peaks and valleys.
Yeah. And then there was the year 2001 when I recorded and mixed the top-selling show ever on Broadway, The Producers. And a big band album, which is, you know, a 17-piece, all-star big band, trumpets, trombones, saxophones, jazz band, for Chaka Khan's favorite classic song. Then we all went over to England, to London, to record at Abbey Road, an 80-piece orchestra, the London Symphony Orchestra, and we got to add that to the mix, as it were, and then I got to mix it. And that was the moment that Eve Nelson, wonderful producer who's since gone to L.A., you know, had a house here in East Hampton. We'd done a couple of projects together with Sandra Bernhardt, live concerts, and because Sandra also sings and plays. And she had a small studio out here, and I didn't really. I had a mix room. It was in New York City, and it was in my apartment. And she had a mix room out here, and I said, well, I'm going to bring all my gear out here, and we're going to mix out here. Because Chaka didn't need to be here. She just wanted to hear the mixes, really, as most artists, large artists do. You know, they can't be sitting there while you're mixing for 20 hours.
Right.
While you're getting drum sounds. That was a really beautiful, big deal. And that was also the year 2006 that I decided I would no longer feel that I lived in New York City. I felt that I lived here and I went there. And up until that time, from 1980, I lived in the city and I came out here.
Right.
So that was kind of a dual arrival. And certainly Paul McCartney and coming to the house and recording here with Steve Martin, who flew in to our sweet East Hampton airport with his wonderful mentor for banjo, Tony Trischka.
Tell me more about that. So it was you, Steve Martin, Paul McCartney.
Well, actually, there were a few more people because we had a chef. An engineer flew up, Steve's engineer flew up from North Carolina with Steve. They brought an assistant. I had an assistant, and we had our friend Marion Megna, an amazing artist and musician, but she's also a great chef. So I said, well, you can chef. you know, because of course I had friends asking if they could hide out in the bushes, which I said, I don't think so. We pride ourselves on high security here, absolutely. And so, you know, really there were just a few of us, but we waited for a while and Paul came. And he is an incredibly talented, regular guy. Put everybody at ease. I think I'll tell one story about that session, besides the fact that he basically, you know, killed it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He went in and did vocals, you know, for as long as Steve wanted him to. He was just wonderful. He came in his Range Rover and just in shorts. And it was just like everyone else out here, you know. People come here in their wetsuits sometimes to do sessions, believe it or not. And I guess my favorite part was how there were like five people sort of staring at him as he came to the door with their mouths open.
Is that really
like,
him?
I'm sure that's what happens to him all the time.
Yeah, I see him at the Golden Pear. I try not to stare, though.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? So he just looked at us and we're like, hello. And he says, hello, I'm Paul. I'm Paul. I'm Paul. I'm Paul. And we all introduced ourselves,
right. You know,
because he was like, everybody, please put your jaw back in place.
Right.
I am a human being and we're here to come do some work. So let's go. A really, really wonderful guy. Rest of it's history. Of course, that single won a Grammy and the whole album won a Grammy. And Steve is a remarkable, wonderful person, musician, as you know, comedian. He's a really cool human being. His buddy is Lorne Michaels, who also lives out here. So there was a reason, you know, it worked out great that Paul was out here and Steve's friend was out here. There were multiple reasons to come here. And that's what I love so much about the Hamptons is that this is kind of like New York City. You know, only New Yorkers would call this like the country. But we do have woods and ocean and privacy. You know, at the end of the day, this place is not an A-list party. This place is a place where people come to chill, entertain.
It just happens to be that the people that come to chill happen to be very famous at times.
At times. And plenty are not.
Exactly.
And, you know, this was my path. And believe me, it's beyond my wildest dreams. And I couldn't have even dreamed it this big. So I didn't make it happen so much as it evolved as it was meant to happen. I'm just like the luckiest person in the world. Don't forget, I'm a service person. Okay, I'm here in the service of music. That's why I'm a monk. That's why this is monk music. Because I'm a monk and this is my temple. And it always has been the day that I got welcomed to the machine in no uncertain terms. Yeah. Your job, should you accept it, should you choose to accept this impossible mission, is to be in the service of music and learn how to do that without getting in the way. Basically, I like to say that we're one-third musician, one-third technician, and one-third a politician. But after a while, anybody who gets to a certain point in their career has done more than their 10,000 hours, and they appear to be part magician only, and they're not. It's just only because once you get really good at something, you make it look easy. And for me to make the environment easy for an artist is really a lot of what I aspire to.
So you touched on this a little bit earlier, but tell us about your record label. Who signed to it? What's the deal with it? Are you currently signing new artists?
Yeah. Monk Music Records was my attempt to, and I'm going to put it in the past tense, my record label is not defunct, but it is not active. We're not actively seeking artists, and the artists that are on the label are few, and there's really one actively producing. So my only reason for wanting a record label, because that is not the business I want to be in. I had a small team. To take on that part of the machine is like, first of all, that's a career in itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's not a sideline.
Okay? That's not a side hustle.
Right. And I was trying to incorporate it in my message by doing one thing. I had one purpose. There's so many people whose talent far outweighs. If it is a sideline, a fallback position to being a producer or a rock star, then go try to do those things, please.
Right.
You know?
You can't half-ass it.
Exactly.
Got to be all in.
Right. And you need to be passionate about this exact thing. It takes all that time and effort. This isn't a sideline, you know? Oh, maybe I'll just become let me just come to a studio because I really want to be a rock star, and this would be a great way for me to meet people. You know, or learn how to make my own records and stuff, you know, because people come to me for all different reasons to work here. And I just really want people who are as dedicated as I am to this job. But I did, you do become a producer. So recording engineering and producing records is very much alive. And the changes that have been technological have given us new means and methods to be creative. So whereas, yeah, were there like decades where we were changing from one medium to the next until the industry could figure out a standard? Yes. Is there constant learning? Thank God. Are new technologies actually showing us different ways in which we can process music? Yes. Have human ears changed? Only perhaps human, the exposure to overcompressed, incredibly loud music that in the minds of many precise audiophiles is not a change in a good direction.
You know, a lot of overproduced music, perhaps?
Well, some of it's overproduced, but we've had overproduced music ever since we've been producing music. You know, think about the 70s. You know, you had singer-songwriters alongside of disco hits. and so production and tastes and creating tastes is hopefully will always be there. How I've seen my job or the situation change is that in a very sad way, because I do still believe in the power of young people, as all the more seasoned people, to hear the difference between well-recorded and well-produced, you know, music where the essence of the artist is captured or not. I don't expect everyone to be thinking about that stuff at all, any more than every Broadway show is for every person or right. Every artist, visual artist, is for every person. The saddest part for the recording industry is that the downside of the change in the recording industry from large studios is that some of the most beautiful rooms, the largest studios, the most amazing training grounds for some of the most amazing engineers and producers in the world are all gone in New York City. They're gone.
Why is that?
Because real estate was too expensive and people's record budgets got smaller and smaller as people realized they could maybe do a lot of things at home and maybe they could get away with synthesizers instead of hiring a whole bunch of musicians. You know, there was a whole thing on Broadway for that. A whole lot of musicians have been put out of work year after year because session work is no longer there. And in LA, a lot of that is that way, but they're still making film music and big scoring stages are still there. Not so in New York. So I grew up in a time when I did not know we were in the golden age and it was about to be over. I was at A&R Recording, the large studio that I started in New York City. And, you know, they were doing feature films all day. Paul Simon, Billy Joel, Steely Dan at night, James Taylor. And there were four studios, two buildings. One of them had the largest room and one of the best sounding rooms in all of New York City, run by one of the greatest producers in the world, Phil Ramone, who basically has produced just about everybody until he died. I mean, it's just, you know, he has a halcyon, a incredibly celebrated career, and he was my mentor. So I was lucky. You know, I trained that way, and we had a ladder, an apprenticeship. So you start at the bottom and you learned how to file tapes and get studios ready for a session. And then you learned how to make tape copies and run the film chain because we actually had huge projectors showing films and we're recording to sprocketed audio tape. And
you like actual reels of film.
Yes, actual 35 millimeter magnetic reels of film projecting onto giant screens and watching musicians play to that and listening to that is an incredible experience. And the first day that I walked into a room with 50 musicians all playing to picture, and I turned and I saw the people behind the glass, you know, laughing and into it. And I was, you know, I was a young apprentice. I had just started. If I was allowed to set up microphone or headphones or even choose the mics and bring them into the room, you know, that was a big deal. And then there I was in the middle of all of this live music. And that was an arrival moment. That was 41 years ago. Upside, and I will celebrate this, is that technology has allowed people of all ages and all levels of music to explore their creative sides in their own homes in ways that they never could. You couldn't afford a recording studio. You went right. And you made a demo of four songs, and that was it. I think music's role has been what music's role has always been. And that is to, for those who love music, for those who find solace in both listening to and making music, has had the potential for to pause all your other activities and go inside and become a more creative and more open person who actually may have the time to listen to all the things they wanted to listen to. And it's, I think it's been an expansive time for artists. So that's what music has done, what it's always done. We're in a wartime, okay? And on a certain level, there's always been a struggle. We're human beings. And amidst those struggles, art has always had the role of expanding our hearts, right? So it hasn't done anything different. Here's where it's been most impacted. The way I live my life is to be compassionate to everybody. And that means that I have to stop judging the people that really, really piss me off.
Right.
Okay, that's just part of my practice, my creed, my Buddhist point of view. So that was interesting. That was a learning moment.
I guess just to wrap it up, what are your favorite things about the East End? And are you happier out here? Are you glad that you made the switch permanently from New York to here?
Yeah, I began to be happy out here the first time I came here in the late 80s, the moment I got out here. And I've lived in a lot of places, mostly New York City. And I loved the city for a lot. I loved the city for a lot of reasons. But the feeling of relaxation that consistently came over me every time I passed the Shinnecock Canal, when I would come back from the city.
Yeah.
And believe me, I wanted to be out here so badly. Sometimes I left at 4 in the morning so I could come and play tennis at EHIT for an hour and do a session for 1 hour out at a different studio in Bridgehampton and then go back to the city. That's how much I loved it and felt at peace here.
Right.
So there was no question that I would get a house here at some point and that this was home. There was never any question. There was only the relief, the same relief I found when I understood that my passion was music and that maybe if I just continued to try, that I could work and thrive in that business. Same feeling. The body keeps a score and in good, for good and for bad. And my body told me every time I came out here, feels so good to be out here. I just love looking at that milk pail as I pass by watermelon. I know I'm on my way home. You know, it's always felt like home. My favorite part, there's very little not to love about my home. Very little not to love about the East End.
I agree. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Cynthia. This has been amazing. Music with Compassion. This is Hampton's Consciousness.
Yeah, I like the name of your show.
Thank you. Tune in, you guys.
Thanks so much for listening to the great monologue as told by Cynthia Daniels. Thank you so much for your time, Enid, and for your interest.
Thank you so much for allowing us into your awesome studio.
Anytime.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to Hampton's Consciousness. Enid and JB look forward to seeing you again in future episodes. Remember, the real Hamptons is not just mansions, beaches, and the rich, but a fragile, natural paradise made up of people who care about their community and the World West of Shinnecock Canal.